Motopod, proudly supported by Roadskin, a UK label specializing in protective outerwear for motorcyclists. Modern biker clothing that you can wear all day long and engineered to save your skin. For the road, for life, visit roadskin.co.uk. Welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 775, the Silverstone Race Review. I'm your host, Jim McDowell. Joining me, as always, across the pond, a man who has had the best British summer you could possibly have because he's spent it at racetracks the entire time, is Richard Jow. Richard, you are fresh back from Silverstone, fresh back off of your Donington trip. You are like the luckiest Brit in the whole island.
Well, there's a few of us, I guess, because there's a few other podcasters that I could mention. But yes, it's been a good few weeks. There's lots of content to put out. And again, like always, a bit crazy with work and other stuff going on. But yeah, we've got the Donington World Supers stuff to put out, which will come out first. And then I managed to nab quite a lot of stuff at Silverstone this weekend just gone, which was a great weekend in many respects. But it's a double-edged sword because there are other aspects about it which weren't so good, which we'll come to in due course. But yes, thank you, Jim. Yeah, it's been a very productive, enjoyable, quite tiring, I must say, and rather expensive few weeks. But yeah, I mean, just love to be at the track. I still get that kind of adrenaline, the hairs on the back of the neck thing going on when I arrive at a track in the morning. You can hear the engines revving in the garage. So yeah, heaven, really.
It is quite nice. I myself actually am on vacation from my daily job. So I'm actually on some dodgy Wi-Fi at our VBRO in North Carolina on the Outer Bank. Anyway, we'll just get right to it then, folks, because we don't know how long the Wi-Fi is going to hang on. So let's start off with some news and notes to try to catch up from what happened in the three-week summer break. So maybe not necessarily in the right order, but the things that we know that happened. One, Pol Espargaró will wild card at the Austria Ring for Red Bull, which I don't think is a surprise. He is their test rider, and they do hand out wild cards all the time. So I think that's kind of what was a known deal. The Kazakhstan GP was canceled, and it's been replaced by the Emilia-Romagna GP on the 20th to the 22nd of September. Now, help me out, Rich. The Emilia-Romagna, isn't that like right near Rome or close to Rome?
Well, it's Misano. Back-to-back races at Misano.
Okay.
And a test as well. So that very much plays into the favor of Pecco Bagnaia, I have to say, because he's been mighty there for the last few seasons. So he gets two stabs at it there and the test as well. So personally, no offense to anybody that loves that track. I'm not a big fan of Misano, never really have been. And we did a double header there, if you recall, as part of the COVID kind of concession in terms of the reduced calendar and the ability to move around. So I was a little bit frustrated when I saw that that had happened. I mean, did it come as a big surprise to anybody that Kazakhstan was gone from the calendar? You could see that one come in months ago. So why they weren't able to line up somewhere a little bit better than a back-to-back at Misano, I find that a little bit hard to understand. But, you know, I'm not the person that's trying to organise the calendar and everything. You know, it's a massive logistical challenge. So I'm not underestimating what's involved there. But I'm a bit kind of not the happiest person about the fact that we've got two back-to-back races there of all places. I don't know what you think. I mean, that's just my opinion.
Well, first, I screwed up. I got confused thinking that it was at Vallonga, which I think is the circuit near Rome, where that scene, like World Superbikes race. I didn't realize that it was going to be at Misano. I don't have a problem with Misano track, per se. But, I mean, from a logistical standpoint, it was probably the easiest place to do it, right? Because you take up that weekend that Kazakhstan was, you can put it there. There's not really any additional travel cost or travel preparation that anybody's going to really deal with, because everybody's going to go there and stay there because they're also going to test there. So I can see the logic of doing it, but
yeah. It's not going to promote a good race because people are going to spend so much time doing laps there that by the time the second, you know, race that takes place, the second race weekend takes place there, everybody's going to be so dialed in that it'll be business as usual. And I suspect that will be Ducati's dominating the front of the field.
Do you really think that, Rich? Or do you think it's going to be more like when Portimao held the opening race of the year, everybody was there testing before? That was a crazy race where everybody knew what they were doing. So it was super tight, super competitive. We had everybody banging into each other at that point. I think what that's where Bastianini got his shoulder destroyed was at that race. Marquez took out a bunch of people at the beginning at what, turn two or something. So I don't know. I mean, it could go either way. I'm not going to argue it.
The likelihood is that the weather will be hot and sunny there because it's that time of year. I don't know. It's very unrealistic of me to say, why couldn't they have gone to, say, Imola? I mean, it's probably not homologated to Grand Prix standard, although World Superbikes have raced there in sort of semi-recent times. Perhaps go back to Mugello because we've had a bit of separation time-wise from that. But again, it's all moving stuff around and it's easier to stay put in one place. I do get that. But on the other hand, they were due to all go off to Kazakhstan. So, moving somewhere else into Europe, you would have thought wouldn't have been quite so big of a challenge financially and so on. But what the hell do I know? It's a piece of news. It's what's going to happen. It's followed, or there's a test in the middle as well. And Honda are testing there again, Joan Mir was telling the assembled journalists at Silverstone at the weekend. So, yeah, I just think it'll be a bit boring, to be honest. But I hope I'm wrong and we'll find out in a few weeks' time, won't we?
Yeah, we won't know until we get there. Well, let's continue down the list of news items. It was announced that before the Silverstone weekend that Raul Fernandez has a 2-year contract to race at Trackhouse. Does that surprise you, Rich?
Yes and no. I think it was probably from a continuity point of view, and he's very, very highly regarded, certainly by Massimo Rivola, who's the team manager head honcho within the works Aprilia squad. So I don't think it was a big surprise on that front, but you'd have to say it's slightly surprising to give him a full 2-year deal on the basis of still somewhat patchy form. He's had a few sort of sparks, Barcelona, he did pretty well throughout the weekend, although he crashed out of the lead, if you remember. I think that was in the sprint. I might be wrong. And he certainly is getting better, but that explosive talent that we saw back end of his Moto3 career and that single season he did in Moto2 when he challenged Remy Gardner for the title, I mean, that Raul Fernandez has not really shown up yet, has he? So Aprilia are putting an awful lot of faith in the fact that he's going to continue to develop and become the real deal. The interesting thing is what happens with the other seat, which we don't know about. It's not a news item. The only news is that there is no news, but it's a bit of a big talking point.
There is a little bit of news there. Well, since we're on Trackhouse, we'll go with this. There's a very persistent rumor that Ayagura is going to be there next year. And that one, everyone is talking about it. It's not just one or two people. It seems like every journalist is talking about it, which usually puts credit to the fact that it's going to happen. And it sort of leaves Roberts out in the cold, which surprises me. I look at Fernandez and I look at Roberts and I kind of see the same thing. I see potential talent, but it's not turned on all the time. So it's like, I understand not having them both, but I would try harder to keep Oliveira on my bike at Trackhouse and then bring in Roberts or Ayagura and do it that way, as opposed to essentially giving Raul sort of that de facto number one in the team. I'm not Justin. I don't know what he wants to do. I don't know if he's sort of hands off of this and it's all Brivio and he's running the show, or is it a consultation? We're not going to know unless somebody wants to talk about it. So it's just odd.
Well, hold that thought, Jim, because one of the, I think probably, well, dare I say, the interview that I was most pleased with over the weekend at Silverstone was with Davide Brivio. And I asked him that question. I mean, not who's riding on the second seat, because obviously you can't ask that. They won't answer that because they're all sort of highly experienced sort of politician answerers when it comes to that sort of thing. I asked him, what's Trackhouse's position? Do they want continuity and experience on that second seat, or do they want young guns, given how many, let's say, four or five potential candidates that you could stick on there from Moto2. Now, we know that the Ayagura rumour has been swirling for a while. And as you say, Jim, that's kind of swirling so much that it sounds as if it's a done deal, just not kind of officially announced yet. But he did imply that they want to go down the youth route, not necessarily because they're a feeder to the Aprilia works team, because Trackhouse is an independent team in its own right. But I think Davide Brivio just has a great track record of working with young riders and bringing talent through, as does your Hervé Poncharal and a few others that you could mention. So I am surprised that Aiguera gets the nod, simply because somebody was pointing out that he still has some contractual money coming in from HRC and is perceived to be the guy that would go and replace Nakagami at some point, and has clearly resisted that offer, if it's quite as explicit as that. So going to Aprilia, I don't know how that works from a Honda point of view, whether he severs ties with them. But he's very strongly supported from the Japanese point of view, because somebody pointed out he still wears an Arai helmet, and he rides currently in the MT squad in Moto2, which is a helmet manufacturer. So there's some weird contractual stuff going on behind that. But he's quite, I would say, I didn't speak to him at the weekend, although he was walking around sort of kind of fairly anonymously in the paddock quite a fair bit. But he's quite sort of un-Japanese in a way, if you know what I mean. I mean, he speaks impeccably good English, so he's quite sort of naturalized into the European scene. So it kind of makes sense to me, and it doesn't at the same time. I know that's a ridiculous thing to say, but you know, he's having a great year, although he didn't have a great race on Sunday, which we'll come to, but he's having a great year on the Moto2 bike again, and he's very worthy of a spot in MotoGP, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think he is worthy of it. They were talking on the broadcast that, Roberts is much older, is a couple of years older than Aguirre. And if they gave him a 2-year deal, Roberts would be touching 30, where Aguirre would still be in sort of in the middle of his 20s. I get that, but I'm not gonna stand here and say Roberts deserves that seat. You get what you earn in my book. But I'm wondering if Joe isn't gonna be coming back to Moto America soon.
My opinion on this, Jim, and I'll sort of do this as lightly as I can, because actually I think that precisely the same thing applies to Jake Dixon. Both Jake and Joe, you know, you could argue on a good day they are worthy of a spot in Moto, or another chance in Jake's case, because he did get a couple of guest rides a few seasons ago. But on their day, they're very good, and obviously we saw this from Jake on Sunday. Joe was a bit anonymous in the race at this time, but he's been really, really good at other rounds this year. But do either of them really definitely warrant, given their age and how long they've been in Moto2, do either of them sort of stand out as the definite go-tos? I would say no, irrespective of passports and Dorna's obvious and ultimately probably Liberty's desire to have an American and a Brit in the premier class. We do obviously need that. But at the end of the day, Trackhouse is in the business of doing what's best for Trackhouse. And if that's Aguirre and Raul Fernandez, then it's within their gift to make that decision, isn't it? And that would appear to be the direction of travel. So it's a tough business. The right people don't always get the gig, and sometimes they do. So it's tough on Joe. But like you, I think possibly he might be looking down the barrel of, you know, either staying in Moto2 for a few more seasons and doing pretty well, or going and earning some better money elsewhere. But it won't be MotoGP, I don't think.
Yeah, I'll say this about the Aguirre choice to go into Trackhouse. He would have a contract for 25 and 26. Maybe at that point, after 26, perhaps maybe I then goes to a Honda machine because that gives Honda that time to work the new machine out, figure the new machine out, and then put him in LCR or Intermezzo for a year and then move him to the factory after that. It's possible that they could be looking at a far-reaching strategy such as that, but I don't know if that's the right move or if that's even in their game plan.
What was pointed out, and this is something obviously we'll be able to look at next season if he does indeed end up at Trackhouse Aprilia, is that Aguirre has an HRC badge on his leathers currently, and always has done. So he's obviously, HRC don't have any involvement in Moto2, so it's not really that big of a stretch that that badging would be there. But given how supported by HRC and the expectation that he would be the next fast Japanese in the top class, if he still has HRC patches on his leathers somewhere next year, then I think that would tell us a great deal. But if that is suddenly invisible, and there might be contractual reasons why that wouldn't be acceptable to Aprilia, of course, but that might reveal something.
Yeah. All right. Let's try to move on here with the news. Mir has a 2-year deal with HRC. That's confirmed now. I think we knew he was going to stay. Rins has a further 2 years commitment to Yamaha, which we learned as well. We also know that the Indian GP, the one on the subcontinent, is a go for the next 3 seasons. So apparently they've worked out the money, they worked out the travel, they worked out the finance, and you're going to be at the Buddha Circuit for the next 3 years. So that's a 25, 26, and 27 deal.
I'm skeptical, Jim. I'm really skeptical because we were meant to be at Kazakhstan the last 2 years, and that hasn't happened.
Yeah, we were supposed to be in India this year as well.
Indeed.
They couldn't come up with what they were doing. So I don't know what they've got going on there. That's just ridiculous. But we'll follow that storyline because there's a lot of time for things to change. The VR46 team, Valentino Rossi's team, gets factory 2025 Ducatis. They become the de facto Pramac squad next year. I think that's great for VR46. It's good for Digya. He gets a factory bike. He could do some damage on that.
Again, I was paying close attention to this at the weekend. So Ducati, what they're actually doing, because this is actually, from my perspective, and I'm interested in your take, this is a big surprise to me. So bearing in mind they've lost Pramac, so there's six bikes for them to put out next year. They're only going to be putting three works bikes out there. Digia, according to an interview which Tardozzi gave on Sunday morning, which was, I don't think it was in the plan that he was going to spill the beans on this because nobody else has confirmed this officially. But what he said was, Digia gets the 2025 works spec bike in VR46. Morbidelli, who isn't even confirmed to be in VR46 yet, by the way, but Morbidelli gets the 24 bike or stays on a 24 bike, which is obviously on this year. And Grassini will run 24 spec bikes, on both sides of the garage for Alex Marquez and presumably Fermin Aldeguer, because that's the only other place for him to reside now. So only three bikes, works bikes, as in 2025 spec bikes next year coming from Ducati, not four, which I'm slightly surprised about, given that we know there are four works Hondas, four works Yamahas, four works Aprilias, and four works KTMs. So Ducati are now out of step with everybody else. What do you make of
It's typical Italian.
that?
They have favorites, right? I mean, I just think that they all have backdoor deals, and I think that they want Italians on the best bikes, right? Digia is Italian, so that puts him and Bagnaia on factory bikes. The wild card of that is the factory bike goes to the other factory bike is occupied by another Spaniard, and it just so happens to be a really, really good Spaniard, like the other Spaniard who used to have it. Maybe he's a step behind, but I think, dude, like having Marquez on the factory bike is like throwing the cat amongst the pigeons, right? His mental game is going to be so good because he played such a great game to get to that bike, right? I don't know if Bagnaia can handle Marquez in his team. Now, I could be completely wrong. I have seen Bagnaia be very mentally sharp and whatnot. But then again, he's never tried it against Marquez. Martin's too tempered to blow up, and it makes it easy for Bagnaia to look more cool, calm, collected, dedicated than it would be against Marquez. Because Marquez is, I in my mind, is a cool Spaniard, right? He very long game, very plodding, very thinking, that kind of a guy. I mean, he might ride like a maniac and throw it away.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. But, well, I mean, obviously, we'll come to the MotoGP races, and it's only one round, it's true. But my abiding takeaway from the Silverstone weekend, I am jumping the gun now, was walking away thinking, are there some people in Ducati wondering if they've made the right choice here?
Really?
I accept that Marquez is on a 23 spec bike, and it's, as we understand it, unless he's received some upgrades over the course of the summer break, probably not. So he's on an old spec bike, and so he's pushing it quite hard. And he has started to crash a lot. We're getting back to vintage HRC Marc Marquez at the moment, where he crashes heavily and often in the last few rounds, not just at Silverstone, but he went down, what, three times over the course of the weekend?
Yeah.
And, Bastianini won both the races. So, I mean, I just wonder whether or not they've really kind of jumped the gun a little bit on this one. Time will tell. Marquez is a, one of the all-time greats. There's no doubt about that. And he will, I'm sure, do a lot of damage in the positive sense of the term on the bike next year. My kind of amazement with what we've just kind of set up is the fact that Ducati is supplying four works bikes this year. Obviously, Martin is on one, the two works bikes. And I think Morbidelli's on one, isn't he?
No.
Or who else is on?
He's on the other Pramac.
I'm sure somebody else is on a works spec bike. It's either Bez or Didier in the VR46. I think. I'm not, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm just surprised that they're pulling back on that when everybody else is going down that road.
I don't remember a time that Ducati has ever put four factory bikes on par. The only other factory bike was one Pramac bike. And as far as I know, they weren't. Now, I could be wrong about that too. Somebody out there knows. Write us. Tell us. Reach out to us on the socials or whatever.
Pretty sure there's four works bikes out there this year, but
Okay.
I may well be wrong about that, and I'm now sort of doing that kind of panic thing in my mind where I'm trying to work out if I've made a mistake. But I just think it's just odd that they wouldn't compete on level grounds with all the other factories.
Yeah, I agree with you. So let me, while you think about whether there's four factory Ducatis or not, let me throw this theory at you too. Yeah, I get Marquez has crashed the bike a lot, and so did Martin. Okay. Martin got a new front wing assembly that he didn't have in Germany. And he says it makes the bike have that little bit more feel in front. Well, if that's the piece that Marquez is missing and Marquez that can't get that new aero front, that would explain why he's crashing. Now, that's just me trying to draw a line between things, but Martin definitely got a new upgrade to his front arrow that he likes, and he says he feels better with it, and that it doesn't feel like it's more predictable, he said. Maybe not better, but predictable, which that's what you want. You want predictability. I can see how that equates to Marquez not having any feel. And he does have a 2023 bike, and it's a very early version of that. But as you said, there are a lot of other people that are riding really, really well that aren't crashing, and he is crashing. So I will always believe that Marquez is there because Dallinia wanted him to be there. I think Tardozzi and who's the head of Ducati? Paolo?
No, it's Domenicali, isn't it?
Domenicali. I think they wanted someone else. Take your pick. It could have been Bez. It could have been DJ. It could be any of those people, right? I think Dallinia won. Dallinia's the guy because he's brought them championships, and he's brought successive championships to them with his genius of how he made that bike work. So you kind of don't tell that guy no when he says, I want him on my bike. It'd be really hard to, and I'll leave it there.
No, I agree, Jim. I think we've discussed this before, that Gigi Dallinia is clearly a huge Marc Marquez fan. And again, you know, Marc Marquez is one of the all-time great riders and may well still hold that kind of lofty position. I just think him on the Works bike next year and year after, let's say next year, goes kind of one of two ways. Either he just runs rampant and we go back to the Marc Marquez of the early HRC MotoGP era, or, yeah, he just kind of crashes a lot, you know, which is what he has had a habit of doing for quite a long time now. You know, Bagnaia makes mistakes, as we saw again this weekend, although when he crashed at the weekend, he had just set the fastest lap. So he was pushing on because he was in fourth and he wanted to get a bit further up. But there is a sort of a kind of icy coolness about Bagnaia, and Bastianini for that matter, now that he's back at kind of full fitness and on a bike he understands. Because we know that he was obviously very badly injured in Portimao right at the beginning of last year. He broke his shoulder, and that's a very difficult injury to come back from. And there were aspects of the 23 bike that he specifically, for whatever reason, couldn't get along with. This year, it is different. And, you know, he was pretty well untouchable this weekend. Critically, he qualified really well. I mean, and that's always the issue with him, because we know he always has great late race pace. So that's how it kind of panned out. So, as I say, I just thought he looked the real deal, Bastianini, this weekend.
For sure.
It's one weekend, although he's been good, really, most of this season, just not historically qualifying that well, which has always been his kind of big weakness, which wasn't the case this weekend. He likes Silverstone. He's a bit of a specialist there. A bit like, you know, Aleix Espargaró loves Silverstone and has always done really well there. Big crashes aside. So, I mean, let's see what happens this weekend in Spielberg. You know, it might be completely different. But I just got this nagging doubt that, you know, they might have backed the wrong horse.
Yeah, it's possible. Oh, let's talk about the British GP slightly. It will not be in August next year. They are moving it to May. What did they say, like 28, 29, 30th of May? Which is probably going to coincide with the Memorial Day holiday here in the U.S., which would put it in the same weekend as Monaco.
I didn't even know that, to be honest with you. I didn't know that had been announced. So, wow, that's a surprising decision, because that will almost certainly be wet.
Yes. Yep, that's what I thought. I'm like, huh, so we're going to have a rain race next year in Britain. That's a good idea. Anyway.
When you're struggling to get a crowd through the gate, sticking it into the end of the May is probably...
Years ago, they moved F1 to, I think, Easter weekend or they something.
Did. Yeah, and look what happened then.
And the car park were just turned into a swamp, and everybody hated it, and they moved it back to British summer, the late July, early August time frame, and it's been there ever since. And, you know, it's like, I mean, I get that you don't want to have MotoGP right there. It's not fair to the British people to have a World Superbike, Formula One race, and a MotoGP race, like, in roughly a month. Like, that's just tough. It'd be like me trying to go to Laguna Seca, then to Texas, and then to, you know, Flat Rock, if potentially they were racing there. It would just be insanely difficult to do that kind of travel and spend that kind of money. But that's what they changed. It's what they announced. And that's what they're going with.
Wow. Okay. I don't know what to think about that, to be honest with you. I'm a little bit... That kind of makes sense with some tweets that I saw about the Monaco Grand Prix weekend in terms of the clash, because I didn't know that's what it was all about. I've missed that piece of news completely, which is a bit embarrassing. But yeah, I'm skeptical about that one, I have to say.
Yes.
Although, can I just press you that?
No, sure.
Let's assume the Liberty thing goes through. Now, next year is way too early for Liberty to have any big effect on what happens at Silverstone. But do I talk about the crowd? Is that just worth mentioning now as part of that
Yeah,
news
go
item?
ahead.
Because
Sure.
so Thursday, again, I was extraordinarily fortunate and I'm very thankful. Motorpod is very thankful to Dorna again, as with you at COTA this year and myself at Qatar last year. Obviously, I got given the media pass. So on the Thursday, I was very busy doing interviews, which obviously will come out in due course. So Thursday and Friday, I was busy in the paddock. I was in the media centre doing stuff with riders and team bosses and stuff. And you kind of get sucked into that bubble where the paddock is really, really busy. And at Silverstone, the paddock is quite big because you're behind the wing building, which is a big, big structure. And you kind of get lulled into that sense that, you know, this is really well attended. But of course, most of the people that you're seeing are either team personnel or they're the sort of the VIP crowd. When you head out into the track itself, which I always do, by the time Saturday and Sunday comes around, I'm sort of going back into, I'm basically a bike racing fan at that point. So I want to go out and watch what's going on the track. And certainly on Sunday, you know, the main day when you've got the three main races going on, I headed over for the Moto2 race to Copse Corner, which is kind of about as far away from the wing paddock as you can get, because Silverstone is a big facility, a bit like COTA Gym, as we've discussed before. And there was basically nobody there. There was nothing there. There wasn't even like a coffee vending stall there. Whereas in previous years, that's been rammed with merchandising stalls, food and drink vendors. You know, there was nothing there at all. And I think the crowd over the course of the weekend was just a whisker over 100,000. And on race day, it was 42,000, which in Silverstone terms, that is effectively empty. Yeah, I mean, it's bad, really bad. I was kind of skimming through X last night because there's the inevitable weekend figures come out and everybody's bitching about Silverstone as a venue. And I personally, and it's not because I've done a couple of interviews and I did one on Friday with Stuart Pringle. He's a really nice guy. I think he's done a superb job at Silverstone. If you look at it as a facility compared to how it was some years ago, it's, you know, they've made a lot of progress there and you can't argue the facts of what they managed to achieve on the Formula One side of things. I had 400,000 in over the weekend a few weeks ago when Formula One was at Silverstone. So it's not really the venue. I mean, people sort of say, oh, it's terrible for spectators and it's rubbish viewing. I personally totally disagree with that. People always go on about Brands Hatch. Well, you couldn't hold a MotoGP race at Brands Hatch. There's no way. It's just not safe enough. It would never get homologated. Then they go on about Donington Park. Donington's a great track, it really is, and it probably could just about scrape through safety-wise, I suppose, homologation-wise, to run a MotoGP race. But as a spectator experience, I don't think it's better, certainly from the point of view of facilities, than Silverstone. So I don't really understand the ire that people have, but you've got to be careful when you're on X because you know, you're a hardcore of a small number of people that are just bitching about it. I think probably most people are fairly reasonably okay with Silverstone as a venue. It's just people don't know about it. I think that's the problem because the racing is great. You know, MotoGP is a championship, all three categories. You know, hell, let's throw Moto E in there as well. Not that they raced at Silverstone, but as a product, I think it's really, really strong. And you know, if you can get 400,000 into Le Mans, which as a venue, I don't think is markedly better or worse than Silverstone, then there's no reason why it can't happen at Silverstone as well. So maybe this is why they've moved the date to May, because it won't clash with things like the World Cup or the European Cup in terms of football. Obviously, we've got the Olympics going on at the minute. As you pointed out, Jim, we've had World Supers at Donington recently. We had F1 at Silverstone recently, and stuff is expensive. I mean, people can't afford to do all of it. And whilst I think the general admission, not with a grandstand seat on Sunday, it's true, but I think the general admission for the 3 days was £170, which, you know, I don't think that's so bad, really, because that's 3 full days. There's all the action going on 3 days. You've got live music in the evenings. Okay, you might not like the music, but that's not really the point. You know, so it's not for lack of trying, but something's not working. You know, I don't have the answer. I don't know. I'm not a marketeer, but I do wonder what Liberty will be able to bring to the party in terms of general awareness of the sport and buoying up people's appetite to actually go and watch these bikes, which are phenomenal to see. I mean, I went on Sunday with my daughter Emily and her boyfriend Trist. He's never been to a motorsport event before, any sort of motorsport. So to go to MotoGP is the first thing. The first thing he saw was Sunday morning. We got there just about in time. The 10-minute warm-up, well, it's only 10 minutes, don't get me started. But anyway, 10-minute warm-up with the MotoGP bikes. We stood on the Wellington straight. They're going past you at, what, 170? And then hitting the brakes. I
Easily.
mean, His face was just like, what the hell is this? You know, it's such a spectacle. The noise, the smell, the feeling that goes through your chest, you know, with these bites, they're so loud and it's brilliant. It should sell like, you know, hot cakes, but it just doesn't. And I don't understand really what the problem is. Yeah, you can say Silverstone's not your favorite place, and it is a big sort of vacuous place. That's true, but it always produces good races, and it did this weekend. So yeah, it's just really kind of dispiriting, and I feel very sorry again because we said this, or I said this last year. I feel sorry for the team at Silverstone because they put a hell of a lot of effort into this thing, and they're poorly rewarded when it comes to MotoGP, unlike Formula One. So I suppose you've said similar things about COTA in the last few years, haven't you?
Yeah, the best part of the track at COTA is 7, 8, 9, 10. And if you want to be there, that's fine. They'll let you go back there, but there's no vending, there's no restrooms, there's nothing. It's like, why? This is the best part of the track. I don't,
Yeah.
why do you want everybody to sit in a grandstand where they're just going straight past the pits? But that's what you want. I think the goal at COTA is to put everybody in the stand so it looks like there's a lot of people there. That's just not the place to see the race from, you know?
Yeah.
Um,
Yeah.
I've often thought this, and I don't know if I've ever said this on the show. But I think it's easier for somebody to relate to Formula One. And the reason I say this is that everybody generally knows how to drive a car. So you can relate in some way to what they're doing at Formula One and go, wow, they're really going fast. That must be hard to do because if I try to do that in my car, I would be in the ditch or, you know, I did try that or I got a speeding ticket or whatever it is. I don't think motorcycles are as relatable because most people, vast majority of people do not ride a motorcycle and they have no idea of the immense amount of skill that it takes to do that and make it look that easy is, you know, incredible. I worry too about what Liberty is going to do with this sport, but I think I worry about it from a slightly different perspective. I worry the fact that they bought Formula One and they just so happened to catch by magic a great show on Netflix and everybody was quarantined and everybody watched it. And now suddenly it became the most amazing thing ever. And they really actually didn't really do anything. And they're reaping massive rewards, and everybody is just heaping all this praise on Liberty. Look what they did. You let some podcasters into the pits for the first time. You allowed the sport to be put onto YouTube by just the average Joe fan without having Bernie running around destroying everybody who posted even a 10-second clip of a car going by. You know, that was taken down. And motorcycles have always been that way. We've posted a lot of stuff from the races that we've been to, and hey, this is really cool. You know, it's there, but I just don't know what they're going to do promotional wise to help it. Maybe they're going to throw money at it. Maybe, you know, they're going to signage it up. They're going to, you know, have TV advertisements and stuff all the time. I mean, I think motorcycles may be on the cusp of breaking out, but if it does, it's going to be a 5 to 8 year run, and then people are just going to be like, no, what's the new thing again? And for who knows, it could be Olympic pickleball. I don't know, man. It's going to be something else that's just going to take it all their attention, especially with Americans. Our attention span is very, very short. It's a little bit here and that's it. So.
But that's a really interesting point that you make there, Jim. I know we need to talk about the races at some point, and we probably condense that bit down a little bit, but because this is important, you know, because our, you know, we don't want to see our sport dying on its arse. The format of MotoGP, even the main race, but certainly the sprint, is absolutely tailor-made for the modern age in terms of social media content and the consumption of quick, punchy, as opposed to say an almost 2 hour Formula One event. So MotoGP and Moto2 and Moto3, of course, in a way should appeal more than Formula One. And what my view on this is that I'm going to pick football, but let's say ice hockey. That's one of your things as well. I would probably hazard a guess that the average soccer, football here, or ice hockey fan is not spending a huge amount of time themselves personally on the ice or on a football field kicking a ball around. They are just tapped into that sport, that spectacle, that event, the people that are involved, the personalities, the stars, etc. That was the magic formula that, and I think you're right. I think they were extraordinarily fortunate with F1 COVID, fortunate inverted commas, because I'm not saying COVID was a fortunate thing for anybody if it wasn't, but the timing and the placement of that was just perfect for that to take off. I think that's the point. Dorna have done a great deal with the sport, but as you alluded to a minute ago, it's kind of like the Bernie Eccleston situation. I think they've taken it as far as they can get. What they need is a mammoth like Liberty, which has much bigger reach in terms of content creation, the social media presence, you know, thinking out of the box in terms of how to promote the sport. Because you don't need to ride a bike to be interested in the sport any more than you need to be proficient on the ice to like ice hockey. You just need to know that it's really good to watch. and then become a long-term fan. And that's the sort of the elixir that we need to kind of find, I think. And I'm hoping that Liberty will do it. Yes, it will come with downsides. You'll get all these idiots on the grid, shouldn't really be there and are only there for their own selfish self-interest. But whatever, we'll just put up with that. And certainly the riders themselves, I mean, this is where Acosta, for example, and I suspect people like David Alonso and Vea and these younger guys, they will quickly see the opportunities and the potential of what's in front of them here in terms of themselves as put marketable personalities, because it's in their interest to do it. Because again, I could have been at Silverstone at 8:30 in the morning on Thursday to start doing interviews. Well, my first one was at 11:30. That was the earliest slot I got. These guys are not under a lot of pressure to be kind of putting themselves out there, and they will have to work harder and be in terms of that side of what they do. I know that it's the bit that they hate the most, but if they want to be part of a much bigger spectacle and earn a lot more money for themselves, which I suppose they would want to do, then they're going to have to behave like Formula One drivers have to behave. And, that will come with downsides for us as kind of content creators, if I don't sound too kind of sanctimonious saying that, in terms of access, because that will get harder again. But if it's for the overall betterment of the sport, I think that's probably a good thing. Because I take your point about everybody drives a car, but and not everybody rides a bike, but a MotoGP bike looks a hell of a lot more like a road bike than a Formula One car looks like the car you drive to work in every day. So it should be more relatable. So again, there's a lot of nuance around all of this, and we'll see what happens. But Silverstone was great races and unbelievably poorly attended, and I feel very sort of downbeat about that, if I'm honest.
Yep, I agree with you, Rich. I mean, there's no magic bullet to figuring this out. You or I aren't going to know it, but I will tell you one thing of my own personal ilk. Like, again, I happened to latch on to ice hockey at a young age. It was just something that was fast-paced, it was quick, and I liked it. But what happened after that was I spent my free time, learning as much as I could about the sport. And that's the disconnect I see today. Like, they want to take the broadcast and they want to pander to the lowest common denominator of people. And I don't think the Dorna broadcast does it as much, but the Formula One broadcast does. They're always explaining qualifying. You can Google that. You can go look it up. There's a million podcasters who've created content that explain how all that works. Go figure it out for yourself. If you're really invested in the sport, you want to know something, figure it out yourself. And for some reason that doesn't happen. And I don't know how to fix it. I just know myself personally, that's how I fell in love with these things, right? Was by learning as much as I could about the sport. And we're just not, that's not there.
Visibility is the problem. I mean, Stuart Pringle made the point, and I think he's absolutely 100% right about this. I think I said to him, if you could change one thing, anything to do with the sport and the promotion and the organization of the sport, what would you change? And he pointed out that years ago, in just about every country, went out on free-to-air TV, so people would happen upon it. And over the course of years, yeah, the little kid running around the living room sees it on the TV, and so that's how you build up that kind of initial interest from an early age, perhaps. Or it's one way that that might happen, whereas everything's behind paywalls now. So unless you're a dedicated fan, and that tends to be people that were invested from the olden days, like us, you won't get new people coming in, particularly when, or if you're not maximizing the social media aspects of it. Now, Dorna are doing their best, and maybe they've just hit the glass ceiling of what they're able to do. And they need somebody with fresh ideas and more reach, which is where, again, where Liberty possibly comes into the mix. But I don't think Liberty is going to suddenly transform the sport. And as I say, even if they do, that will come with some downsides. But yeah, I mean, all you can do is report what you see. And you've said over previous seasons that COTA has been thin on the ground, big event, big venue. So 100,000 people can look pretty lost in an event, the size of COTA and certainly the size of Silverstone. But my opinion is, whilst Formula One is getting better, it has to be said, that is true in terms of the racing. For the MotoGP crowd to be less than a quarter of what Silverstone packed in for F1, something's badly wrong there.
Yeah. All right. Let's finish up the news real quick, and we'll have to get to the racing. That's what we're here for. The intact Husqvarna Moto2 team will not be a Husqvarna intact Moto2 team next year. Husky, from the way I take it, is withdrawing all of their support for that Moto2 team. And the intact team will still be there next year, but it will not be branded as a Husqvarna.
Just a marketing exercise, isn't it? I mean, it's
Yes,
not a Husqvarna, is it?
no, it's not, and nor is there really a gas moto GP bike,
Yeah.
which won't be, it won't exist next year anyway. So
That would go as well. Yeah.
yeah, so yeah, again, it's a marketing exercise. This was your little tidbit, Rich, which I did not pick up on, is that Simon Crafar will replace Freddie Spencer as the chief steward next year. I think that's a great idea. I think he's a perfect guy for it. I think there's going to be a lot more openness, a lot more visibility there, and a lot more accountability, I think, as well.
Yeah.
So hopefully that's going to work out well. Interesting to see what Freddie does. I'd love to see him do some color work, because I always thought that when he was talking on the motorcycle races in the US, when he was commentating, I should say, I always thought they did a really good job of explaining to you what the rider was feeling at that particular time. So I think that could be really good if they, if Simon and him sort of just swap places and you go to a three-man broadcast crew and Freddie is just the color guy who explains to you what happened in a crash, explains to you what that rider is feeling. Let him have some nuance to talk about what's happening with each rider as we go through the practice sessions and through qualifying, but then have him, you know, sort of take a step back to the actual race thing. So that's what I like to see happen. I don't know about you, Rich, if you've got any comments on that.
Well, I've talked to far too much already, but I mean, I think it's a good appointment. The reasons for Freddie stepping down are not official. He comes under a lot of scrutiny and a lot of flack from riders, teams, fans, just about everybody. I mean, it's not all down to him, but there is this consistent, if this doesn't sound like an oxymoron, a consistent inconsistency with the way that the rules are adjudicated. I think the bigger issue, though, the persistent kind of thing is that there is just no interaction between the race stewards and the decisions that they make and the people that want to understand. Often it's journalists that want to understand this. So I don't know. I mean, whether that was an advertised position you had to apply, I don't know. Or whether it was just like, oh, Simon, do you fancy taking over from Freddie? I don't know. But I think Simon Crafar, you know, he's a bit younger. He's a bit closer to what's been going on in recent times. I mean, Freddie hasn't been racing a bike competitively for a long, 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 long time. So I don't know how old Freddie Spencer is now. Jim, you probably have a better idea than I do.
He was 21 years old in 83 when he won his world title, or real close to it. So 83 to what? 93 to
He's pushing
2003.
late
Yeah,
60s, isn't
23.
he?
He's late
Probably.
60s. He's got to be 62 or more
So
at
maybe he
that
just wants
point.
to go do a Casey Stoner and go fishing, get out of the limelight, get out of the flak.
I think he may spend a lot more time with the ladies of Moto America who run in the BTR, the Build Train Race. He's always got a lot of posts on his social media feed about talking to those girls and explaining things and how things should feel and what change that feeling that you had and all those kind of things. So more of like a rider coach kind of a thing. And he may do that.
Go back to the grassroots a little bit. Yeah. Well, and so, you know, I think him stepping down is probably a bit overdue given the amount of criticism there has been of how that bit of the organisation has worked. And whilst people will have an opinion about Simon Crafar, I think he's a really good guy. Obviously, I had him on the show a couple of years ago. He's closer to the action, he's closer to the teams. You know, he's a racer, he knows what he's talking about. He's pretty firm in his opinions, and I think he'll be resolute in what he does, and he'll explain the reasons for what he's done, or him and his team anyway. So overall, my opinion, people can disagree and they can send in the comments if they want, but for me, that's a very positive appointment.
Okay, last thing in news and notes, Rich, give me your podium of retro liveries from Sunday.
A Honda, Aprilia, Yamaha.
I had Honda Yamaha track house because I love the idea of all the pictures of the Americans who had actually won a race in MotoGP. And I gave Aprilia the honorable mention because I did love the retro Tresker Field
Yeah.
logo that Biaggi used for all a lot of his 250 championships. So, yeah.
Great paint scheme by Grassini as well.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Jim, again, I know we've got to get to the races, but
Yes.
this is a classic example, you see, of what's not right in MotoGP. You could have blinked and missed the 75th anniversary colour schemes, really. Great idea, but again, they didn't really make as much of it as they should have done. I mean, why the hell did they only do it on the Sunday for one thing? Why not just do it for the whole weekend? Because
Sponsorship.
even I was struggling a bit to sort of see who was where, because I was stood out at, well, I tend to move around a little bit when I'm watching a race, but I was largely down at Woodcote Corner. And it took me a little while to figure out who was who, because you're only seeing these people on the Sunday, you know? And so for me, it was just a bit of a missed opportunity. They could have made a bit more of it. And so it kind of fell a little bit flat. Now, perhaps I'm being overly negative and nitpicky, and I am inclined to do that because I'm a sort of grumpy old 52-year-old nowadays, and so that's part of my privilege of life is to be like that irritating sod that just moans all the time. But I just think they could have made more of it. Again, let us know what you think out there in Motorpod land. But it was such a great idea, and some of the bike schemes were great. I mean, Ducati. I mean, I just don't know what they were thinking. That was a poor effort from them, but that works. Ducati, I'm talking about. But maybe, like you say, sponsors ruled the roost on that because it did have an impact. But yeah, good idea, poor execution, and which is a criticism you can sort of level on multiple fronts, isn't it?
Yep, for sure.
But I agree with your choices. The Honda definitely for me number one
Oh yeah.
by a country mile.
Oh yeah, it was the best. I said, I think I what's that to you? And said I had Freddie Spencer vibes, which I did.
Yeah.
That's what it's supposed to bring that up. I mean, the Yamahas were really a close second for me because there was the red and white scheme. I don't really remember the bumblebee yellow. I don't really remember the red white as much,
Yeah.
but still, it looked great. It's still. You knew that was a Yamaha, right? You knew that was a Honda, and you knew that the Aprilia was the Aprilia, right?
Yeah.
Those things all fit, and that's okay. But I think you had a hard time. Well, that's just Ducati's scheme, isn't it? Or that's just VR46's scheme, or whoever. But anyway.
Cynically, you kind of felt that with the words Ducati, it was kind of begrudgingly what Lenovo were prepared to accept contractually as a paint job. Whereas when you looked at the Honda, you might argue that Honda don't have that much sponsorship on the bike this year, so it was less of an issue for them. Again, but slightly cynically, but everybody else kind of embraced it. You kind of felt that Ducati maybe were, shackled a little bit in
Yeah.
terms of what they were able to do.
Agreed.
And I'm pretty sure it was Joan Mir had a sick Randy Mamola helmet
Yes.
design as well to go with the HRC classic livery. So that just looked awesome. I know they were
Yes.
right at the back and nobody saw them, which is rather unfortunate, but it was a great looking package.
Yeah. A shout out to Zarco's Castrol bike, which was meant to mimic the 250cc championship of some year that I can't remember off the top of
Yeah,
my head.
that did look good as well.
But a shout out to Zarco for winning the Suzuka 8-hour. So,
Indeed. Yeah. And
anyway.
apparently Pecco Bagnaia wants to do it next year.
Yes. So, we shall see. Let's get to the racing because,
Yeah.
oh, whew, it's been a long while. You guys have been waiting for this. I appreciate you hanging in
Let's get
there.
through this as quickly as possible, Jim.
Yes, let's try to do this as fast as possible. Moto3 qualifying, the first round. Munoz and Adrian Fernandez were in that first session. I don't think that was really expected from those two, but yet there they were. But at the end of Adrian Fernandez, Feroli, Zura to this one name I still haven't figured out. Zura to Zuza got through, and so did Bertelli. Munoz had a crash at turn seven where he tucked the front and it was chattering. Now that is the worst feeling in the world that you could possibly have on a motorcycle, his front end chattering, especially as much as what he had. There was no way. I cannot give you a great explanation of how it feels when the front end has chatter in it, other than the fact that either your teeth feel like they're going to be rattled out of your gum, or you literally have zero feel for what the front end is doing. Like it could literally have turned sideways, and you'd be like, I don't know if it's really sideways or not. It's just a really odd feeling, and it's dreaded among most guys with motorcycles, and it's something that was just wickedly obvious on his machine. Anyway, those are the guys that got out of there. So Munoz would start like 21st. Then we got into the second qualifying session. Everybody was sitting in the pits. Nobody wanted to go out. I think halfway through, only five guys had actually set a time. It was basically empty. It's empty so much to the point that I think the fast guys only got two flying laps to put in a qualifying time. We knew at one point that we had Ortola, Vire, and Alonso were your top three, and they all had one more lap to go. Wasn't sure how this was going to work out, but Ortola did take pole. Vire was second. Then Joel Kelso had a really strong weekend. He was third. He was on that front row, followed by Alonso, Yamanaka, and Jakob Rolsteen. That's how the race was going to start with those guys. Now, I'll tell you straight, Rich, right off the bat, this is a barn burner race. This is a fantastic race. I mean, I literally have the words wow written at the very last line of my notes because this thing just kicked off and just went nuclear, like right off the bat.
Yeah.
It's a 15 lap race around Silverstone, and those 15 laps feel like they go by really pretty quickly, especially when the action is just as great as this is. But you give these guys three great places to pass, and it's going to work, right? So the start of the race, Ortolo had the whole shot. Kelso was right there with him, and then Kelso jumped out to the lead. It was great to see that. I've interviewed Joel. I thought that he sort of fell off the wagon a little bit there after COTA with the first turn, not the first turn, but the first lap incident that he had. But it was good to see him like finally find form again, because he really had seemed to have gone off into the wilderness. Followed by Ortola, Yamanaka, Alonso, Poggarra, and Nepa. Munoz went from 21st to 9th. Vire was from the front row, went back to 7th. Then we look, and suddenly Munoz and Rolstein were in the gravel trap at Vail, which what we found out was that Rolstein would actually get a long lap penalty because he basically took Munoz out into the gravel with him, which was quite crazy, to be honest. We found out that Ogden, Perez, and Piqueras were all down at the last corner of the lap. We didn't know what had happened. It took a little bit to kind of piece this one back together again, but apparently Piqueras actually high-sided, and the bike came back onto the track, and it left Ogden with literally no place to go. He simply had a motorcycle that just literally appeared in front of him, and that took him out. And then his teammate, Perez, had his own separate incident that I never did see exactly what happened to him.
I don't think they caught it on camera, no.
It may not have been caught on camera. That's the one thing is like, if you don't watch the TNT version of it, you don't sure if somebody actually caught it somewhere and you just didn't see it or what the heck happened. But that's where we were with 10 laps to go, because all this happens in these first 5 laps. It was just chaos basically everywhere. But Kelso, with 10 laps to go, Kelso is out front, followed by Horgarda, followed by Alonso, Nepa, Ortola, and Suzuki. Now, those guys all sort of stay roughly in that order, but they're passing each other back and forth all the time. And there's a lot, there's not, I don't want to call it a lull, but for the 5 laps between 10 to go and 5 to go, it's just sort of basic going back and forth kind of something. It's just you, it was like for a second, they finally decided to calm down, put in some laps, and then at the end, really just come back at this really super hard. With 5 to go, you had Ortola leading Helgardo and Alonso. Vire had now caught the front pack and had put himself into fourth place. Nepa was there, then Adrian Fernandez, and then Kelso, who had one bad move. He got shuffled back, I think, at the start of the lap in Abbey, and he went backwards 7 places, to which he basically could not recover and come back forward. Now, maybe he did use a little bit of the tire up at the beginning because he was running pretty hard in the first part of the race. Who knows? But it goes to show that if you're not almost millimeter perfect for the entire race sequence in Moto3, you are going to wind up going backwards and you can't recover and come back forward again. It's really that close. With Kelso having had this bad moment, that gave Ortola sort of a little bit of a set time to actually jump away. And he had about a half a second lead over Vire and Holgado. Like I said, Kelso dropped 7 places, but it didn't really matter because the guys caught them all back again. Vire would take the lead with about 3 to go, followed by Alonso and Ortola and Holgado. Now then it's on at this point. These guys are just going after each other. It's a crazy, crazy thing. But I had this opinion. I don't know if you could tell as you were being there, Rich, because I mean, I got the advantage here on this one because I could see everything going on from the TV perspective. I really felt like Alonso had this because this was like classic Alonso. He had got himself to the lead with like 2 to go. Ortolo was right there with him in Vire, then Holgado and Nepa and Kelso. And I'm like, okay, this is it. Alonso's just going to ride in and he's going to win this race. But boy, there was a lot that happens in the last lap. Like I said, there's three great overtaking places that happened to be at the Silverstone layout that we're using. And my gosh, these guys decided they wanted to go through everything. Vire would go back to the front, followed by Holgado and Ortola. So they push Alonso back to fourth. And he had a little bit of a moment in the turn. And that's why Alonso had trouble. And I think that was at the beginning of the lap. I think it might have been like right after the turn, right before they go down the Wellington straight. But then Alonso pulls it all back together again. And here he comes to the front. We're halfway through the last lap. Vire's there, Ortola and Alonso. Then Ortolo goes by Vire, and of course that upset Vire. So here comes Alonso. He's going to take advantage of that to move into second. That puts Vire back there, and that was an absolutely epic move by Alonso because that was at Maggots, which is right after Copse. It was an incredibly high speed corner. You're going to the famous Copse, Maggots, Beckett's, Chapel. I think Stowe ends you there. I think no, Stowe's at the end of the hangar straight, I believe.
Yeah.
that section of that track was incredible, and they rode through it two wide, which shows this kid's got some balls, man, because that is a very fast part of the circuit. But Ortola would run the last lap of his life to beat Alonso and Vier with Holgado, Nepa, Yamazaka, and Kelso in that order. It was wicked crazy. It was an incredible race. It was that wow that happened. It was probably one of the, I think for me, it was the best Moto3 race of this year.
Yeah, I'd go along with that. I mean, I was obviously in the stands, so you don't get to follow the race quite as closely as you would on the TV. Although there were some screens, but they're a bit far away to really follow it closely. And I haven't had a chance to watch it back fully yet. But what is amazing me about Moto3 this year, Jim, as a general overall for this season, is how well the racing is always hard, but how incredibly few crashes there are as part of all of this, because they're dicing, they're going four or five wide at times into turns. I mean, down at the bottom of the Stowe, or going into Stowe at the bottom of the hangar straight, they're four or five wide a lot of the time. And certainly some of those moves that you saw throughout the race going into the maggots bit, but there's not a lot of room there. They're going in very, very fast, and that is a tight turn on a bike. And going two or three wide there is a recipe for disaster. And there was a bit of rubbing, bit of bumping and boring going on, but everybody pretty much stayed on board. So just remarkable, really. Like you, I thought Alonso was doing what Alonso does and just lurking in fifth place for most of the race, and then was going to do one at the penultimate lap and then going through the last lap. But no, great ride by Ortola, and he did what he needed to do, which was to not pull that many points back on Alonso, but he got a few back. And Alonso is just the real deal. I mean, again, just to sort of prep what will come, hopefully in the next week or two, I spoke to Ortola, I spoke to Alonso, I spoke to Jacob Ralston, so and Joel Kelso as a follow-up chat, although Joel is typically Australian. I mean, what was scheduled as a 20-minute discussion lasted 7 minutes because you get very short, concise answers. Fine. They're all super kids, and Alonso in particular. I mean, he's the real deal. I mean, he really, really is. And so that's a really good chat. I'm hoping that comes out well in the edit. So great race, Jim. Just brilliant. Absolutely brilliant to watch.
Yes, it was. So just quickly, the point standings. Alonso still leads at 199 points. Ortola is second on 146. He's 53 behind. Holgado is on 133, which puts him 66 behind. Alonso 13 behind Ortola. Then Vier is in at 131, leaving him 68 behind Alonso and two just behind Holgado. Munoz has got 80 points. It really, these guys down below, there's no shot of them for the championship. I don't think they're already, 111 points behind, although anything can happen. But think about it. Literally, Alonso could not race two races, and Ortola could win both of them, and Alonso would still be leading by 3 points, which in Moto3 world, that's bizarro. That it's really not. I was trying to think. I can't really remember a Moto3 championship that was this big of a lead. I mean, there's got to be one somewhere in there somewhere. I'm thinking maybe Martin had a pretty good sized lead at one point, but he did have some crashes through one part of the season. But anyway, that's how that race ended. And that's how the championship looks with Moto3.
Yeah, nothing more to say. Just a brilliant race and well ridden by all concerned, given how fast and tight they were.
Oh yeah, incredible race. Absolutely incredible race. Let's quickly go to the Moto2. We find out in the first qualifying session of Moto2, Audiger is sitting there. Well, that's a big name in the wrong spot. Audiger has shown flashes of brilliance. I mean, Qatar, he won in Germany 3 weeks ago, and now he was there. Now, I will say that we were on board with Audiger in that session, and it was so cool to hear the triumph on the rev limiter as he would go through Cops, Maggots, Beckett, because the bike would be perfectly fine, and then he'd lean over and he'd shorten the diameter of the circumference of the tire, and he would go bang on the rev limiter for a little bit until he whipped it back the other way, and then it would come off the rev limiter. It was super fun to ride that whole lap with him, and you're just looking out the front. Incredible. So that was really, really, really awesome to see. But Audiger, Arenas, Bowman Schneider, and Alcoba all got out of the first session and go into the second session. In the second session, we were halfway through that whole deal with Iger out front, Kennett second, which is a bit of a surprise, because Kennett had dominated practice. He had dominated the weekend to this point in time, and that Calex looked that his Calex looked to be perfectly suited to the track and to the conditions. But Iger held true and kept the Boscacorra pole run intact, and he would, I agree, that is, would be first. Canette would be second. Then Morbidelli was third. Then Vietti, Dixon, the home favorite, would qualify on the middle of the second row. And then Arenas, who would come through the first qualifying session, would be there in sixth. Of note, the people that are also important to us in here, Roberts qualified ninth, which was not a great qualifying session for him, despite him liking this track. Audiger would come through in 11th. Arbolino would be 12th. And the point leader, the guy I haven't talked about at all, Garcia, had a terrible qualifying session and qualified 16th. So there was a lot of work for Garcia to do, but it looked like Iaguirre was in the hot seat to take a whole lot of points, potentially, off of Garcia as they got into the Moto2 race. Now, in the race, Iaguirre just got an absolute blinder of a start. It was like, I almost thought he jumped Rich. You probably weren't anywhere near the start, were you?
No, I wasn't.
Way there.
No.
Okay. So I thought he either cut the light perfect, or I thought, oh, I'm waiting for this to come up as, you know, under investigation for jump start. And I thought for sure by about the fourth lap, they'd been like telling Iaguirre he had to take like a long lap. He did not have to, but he did. Now, Garcia got caught up in an incident in the first turn. I forget who crashed in front of him, but it took him way out wide and dropped him all the way back to 24th because he had to go off the track to get there. Dixon would get to third, and then Canet would get by Agura, and then Iger would be second by the end of that lap. Now, Roberts did get work himself by Vietti. Dixon got by Agura for second. Masia had a major crash at the end of the hangar straight entrance. Like, he high-sided coming out of Cops Maggots. I guess it's Beckett's there, I think. Or Chapel, sorry. Because there used to be an old, the Air Force, when the Air Force was there, they used to have a church there at that corner. Like, so it was Chapel. And he just high-sided himself, destroyed a motorcycle. That thing just went into pieces like it had been hand-grenaded by itself. Now, Dixon did sneak by Agura. And Roberts, who was on a charge, he was also able to go by Iaguirre there because Roberts suddenly showed up in third. And, you know, he got by to get there. And I thought, oh, okay, this is really kind of tasty. Roberts is, you know, didn't qualify well. That's okay. He's made a start. He's got this going. And I'm okay with that. I'm like, okay, cool. Can he bridge the gap? Because Kennett and Dixon are getting away. And I thought, wow, Roberts is carrying enough speed. He might be able to catch these two guys and put up a fight. But as soon as I got excited, front end goes at, what is this? It's what, is it the first turn there? Abby, I think, Rich,
mm-hmm.
Was where he wound up crashing. So Roberts did crash and go down there, which was not that good. Well, we had Iaguirre suddenly just started to get to a point where he like literally started to collapse. I'm not sure what happened to Iaguirre. I haven't read anything that told me what he had as a problem, but Iaguirre just slowly started to go fading backward. Remember, Canet and Dixon are kind of gone. So the racing is pretty much just in this last little bit is what is the third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth kind of an action there. And man, there was some great racing when there were some runs down Wellington. Iaguirre just had these incredible wiggles. And so I think he had some rear tire issues that nobody else seemed to have. And the bike just didn't have grip. And it would just wiggle and he'd catch it. He'd bring it back or whatever. It was really interesting. Now, Marrero would go down at Brooklands at turn six. And like I said, Roberts tried to close in at this point, but falls at Farm. So I was like, man, there you go. It's what, you know, they were talking about how Joe had got overlooked to go to Trackhouse. And I'm like, well, that's kind of the reason you had a chance to take points. You know, Iger is behind you and you know, Garcia is still behind you. And no offense to Canet or Dixon out front, but Joe isn't racing them for the world championship. So all he had to do was just kind of cool it a little bit and take a handful of points, but he couldn't, you know, he did have to toss it away, which was a bit disappointing for me. Again, Iger is just going backwards or whatever. Gonzalez would get by Arenas for third. You know, Aggie had a high side. And then lo and behold, Garcia has now made his way up, or take your pick, Iaguirre went backwards towards his teammate to where Garcia, with seven laps to go, got past Agura. So it was like Christmas had come early for Garcia because everybody in the championship chase was now suddenly behind him or was standing at the side of the track. With three laps to go, Garcia had brought himself up to fourth. But with the last, so we finally get to the last lap where basically it's Kennett against Dixon. And could the hometown kid take it to the guy who had been leading the whole race? And man, that was a great last lap. Man, when they went through Cops, Maggots, Beckett's together, that was just wicked. But Dixon pulled off the move, and because he had got him, Dixon had got passed at the beginning of the lap, I should say, right before the Wellington straight. And so Dixon's leading, and then as we get around, the Cops, Maggots, Beckett's area is where Canet was always pulling the lead on Jake. But Jake somehow got through that with Canet just now anchored to his rear tire. But he held on to it all to win in front of the home crowd. It had to be great for you. I'm sure it was great for the crowd that was there, Rich. But Canet would finish second. Then it would then be Vietti, Garcia would finish fourth. Then Gonzalez, Bender, Alcoba, Arenas, Lopez, Aegis, Vandegerberg, Audiger, Bowman, Schneider, Agura, and then Ramirez. What did you think? Tell us how it was there, Rich, because I mean, Dixon wins in front of the home crowd.
Well, again, I was down at Cops Corner for that part because Moto2 was the final race of the
day.
MotoGP part of the day. The Stock 1000 from the BSB category were out racing later in the day as well. But, well, again, Jim, I understand why they do it from a TV scheduling point of view, but most people kind of left, or lots of people left, after the MotoGP race. So a lot of people didn't get to see Dixon win his home race. And certainly where we were down at Cops Corner, I'd be generous if I said there was 100 people there. Probably more like 50. So in terms of the great atmosphere when the home hero wins the race, well, there wasn't much of an atmosphere, and it was a real shame because Dixon rode a very clever race in actual fact. He allowed Canet to do all the work. Maybe he was saving his tire a little bit as part of that. Obviously, I'm never quite sure to what extent home advantage is a thing, because Dixon's probably not raced any more laps around the Silverstone GP circuit than most of the rest of the field out there, to be honest with you. So he just nailed it, didn't he? He's had a pretty up and down season for various reasons, mostly injury related, but also because he was put onto the WP suspension at the beginning of this season. It's taken them a long time to figure out the settings for that. He's had a good few races recently, particularly good at Assen, wasn't he? And that was just a stellar performance, you know, and it makes you wonder why he hasn't had more of a shot in MotoGP, really. But for me, the standout of the day, as much as Jake was awesome, but he got into second early, just sort of hounded and tracked behind Canet, and then just killed him on the penultimate lap. And as you say, rode a stellar final lap to pull away, enough to make it not a comfortable victory. But anyway, for me, Garcia was the standout rider of the day because, as you say, he didn't have a good qualifying for whatever reason, I don't know, 16th. Had that problem that he got caught up with that dropped him to 24th, and then just relentlessly went forward. And at one point, he was in third. He just missed out on the podium at the end to Vietti, as you pointed out. Whereas, by contrast, Aguirre, you could just see it happening. I was at Cops. That's a fast entry turn, and then it's very hard on the gas as you go for what, I don't know, not quite a quarter of a mile, but an eighth of a mile, say, up to the Maggots turn. And after about eight laps, he was just being dragged out of that turn by everybody. And so you could just progressively see Aguirre conceding place after place after place. And it was entirely, as you pointed out, Jim, he just completely ran out of rear grip. Now, whether he went a bit too hard early on out front, I didn't seem to be going that crazy to me. So whether it was a tire issue, or I don't know if he threw a wheel weight or something basic like that, who knows? But he just went backwards and backwards and backwards. And Garcia, by contrast, just went forwards and forwards and forwards. So it was a great ride by Garcia. That's the sort of ride that you look back at the end of the year and think, yeah, that was the one that we might say won him the championship, because he didn't panic when a lot of people would have done.
Yeah. I mean, he kept his cool against some really good customers, right?
You know? Yeah, absolutely.
The fact is that this race was super easy to figure out tires. Everybody was on the same set. There was no difference. Everybody started on the same tires. So whatever wasn't working for Aguirre was working for Garcia.
Yeah. And of course, nobody's ridden Moto2 on Pirellis at Silverstone before. So it was a truly level playing field in that sense. So a really interesting race in that way to me. Just a shame there weren't more people there to see it.
Yeah, that stinks that there wasn't anybody there. I mean, I would have thought that if they reorganized COTA and they ran the Moto2 race last, I would stay, because I know I got an American in there. And there's that potential he could win on home soil, which I think everybody would want to see, right? It's kind of like Miracle on Ice 1980. Man, you want it to be at Lake Placid, because there's that potential. So I mean, I get it. It's a Sunday afternoon, and I'm sure people want to beat the traffic, and they came to see the MotoGP stars. But I think that's something else that Liberty needs to look at, is retaining the people that are in the crowd, or at least getting the crowd to show up for the first races of the weekend.
Yeah.
Because I've seen, I've sat at COTA, and it's like, well, hey, the Moto3 guys are racing. Oh, cool. And you look around and there's nobody there. Now, that doesn't mean that they aren't in the paddock. It doesn't mean that they aren't buying stuff. It doesn't mean they're not walking around doing other things. But I'm like, why did you not come for the race? You
Yeah.
know?
Yeah. No,
It
I
is
agree.
weird.
It's really bizarre, really bizarre. I mean, obviously there were lots of people were still there to watch Jake win his home race, and that was great. But all I'm saying is that as I walked up to Cops Corner before the Moto2 race started, there were lots of people leaving the circuit through the exit that was next to Cops Corner. And I'm thinking, really? The one Brit, well, Scott Ogden was in the Moto3 race, of course, but Jake is a genuine race potential winner, certainly in terms of his recent form. So you would have thought that that would have been enough to keep people in place. But yeah, people have got to drive several hours to get home, and you understand all of that. But years ago, and I know this is already going on far, far too long, but years ago, I used to go to a one-day rock festival concert called the Castle Donington Monsters of Rock at the Donington Racetrack, held in the infield park. It was a one-day festival. You had AC/DC, Maiden, Whitesnake. The big bands would always play headline there. And I was always amazed. You'd sort of turn up at 11 o'clock on the bus, and by 5 o'clock, around the time that the special guest act was coming on stage before the headliner a couple of hours later, there's literally people that are just paralytically drunk. And you think, why come? You could do that at home. And it's kind of the same deal with people that go to races and then don't watch two-thirds of the races. I don't understand it really, but each to their own. I mean, if you paid the money to go through the gate, it's up to you what you do with it, I suppose. But yeah, it's kind of a curious way to behave for me. I'm just a nerdy wannabe trackside as much as I can, so maybe I just have a kind of an odd skewed view of the way things should be done.
Well, I think we both have that odd skewed view, if you ask me, Rich, because I'm same way. I want to see every bit of whatever it is it's racing. But anyway, it was a great race by Dixon, but it doesn't really do a whole, but because Garcia had a great race as well, and you are correct, Garcia did probably have the ride of the afternoon. Garcia now has 160 points to Iger's 142, which is an 18-point difference. Roberts stays on 123, but he's only 37 away from Garcia. So mathematically, Roberts still has a shot at it. Audiger, he's on 112, and that's 48 off of Garcia, which, it's not two races, but it's darn close to two races. So he's probably the last person who's got a shot at it, because Lopez is only on 100 points, which leaves him a full 60 behind Garcia. This championship is still going to have some twists and turns in it. For whatever reason, this year with the Pirellis, the Boscacoras coming good, and the Kalexes not being as great on Pirellis as they were on Dunlop, is causing a bit of a shuffle here and there. So I look forward to this one continuing on, and I really think of all the championships, this one's probably going to go down to the wire, and I think it's going to be a lot closer than what we think.
Agreed.
Anyway, let's look at MotoGP. That's why we're here, with all the good stuff that comes with MotoGP. And we looked at the first qualifying session. There's Morbidelli, there's Alex Marquez, there's Acosta. I think Acosta might be sort of the odd man out in this, because both Binder and Miller were directly into the Q2. So whatever KTM had lost, they still lost and didn't find it while they were on walkabout, basically, for the 3 weeks in between, because the kid's still lingering in the bottom part of qualifying, which sucks. But Alex Marquez would be first, then Acosta, then Morbidelli, and then Raul Fernandez. So those were the guys that were the fastest. But again, Alex Marquez, sorry, and Acosta are going to get into that second qualifying session. Second qualifying session, Bagnaia bang on into the 157s, which was a wicket last time. Then Bastianini blasted a pole with a 157.9, and you're like, okay, it wasn't like, he beat the 157.97 with a 157.93. So okay, that's all good, But then Bagnaia came back and lowered it to a 157.5, which was just incredible. But Bastianini did come back with a 157.6, and then Martin was there, followed by like Espargaro and Marc Marquez and Vinales. So then Bagnaia goes out for the second half of the session on his second tire. He gets out on a, and what was a really great move, he got the VR46 boys between him and Mark Marquez. Marquez wanted to use Benyai as a toe. He always needed, he said he needed a toe. He had to have a toe. And sure enough, somehow Benyai managed to get him between them. So then he's leaving the VR46 boys. Marquez is like, well, you guys are in front of me. This is not cool. It's like, dude, you were looking for a toe. It is your fault for being in the position that you were in. You know, you don't complain about the VR46 boys not being fast enough when you were looking for a toe yourself.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a bit painful to watch him be all upset with those two guys when really he only had himself to actually blame for it. But Benyai would run wide at Abby. And I was like, what the heck happened? There was, he was in fobbling with his helmet and he pulled a tear off and, you know, he was one of these like, what the heck happened? And they had said that one of the sponsor stickers that was on his visor had fallen between the tear offs and blocked his vision.
Okay,
imagine trying to ride not being able to see.
Jeez.
So he ran off straight, grabbed a tear off, got that off there, got the sticker off, and was able to be there. But with that problem happening, that meant Benyai wasn't going to get a second run at all. Marquez wasn't getting a second run because he was behind the VR46 boys, which was kind of crazy. But that left Aleix Espargaró on a track that he says he'll miss in retirement, will miss only second, is second only to what he would miss as Catalonia. Turns in a cracking 157.3, some 2/10, almost 2/10 faster than what Benyai had put down. And so Aleix would take pole, followed by Benyai, Bastianini, Martin, Alex Marquez, and then Brad Binder. Acosta would wind up being ninth. So that was a kind of a crazy, wild, goofy kind of qualifying session, a little bit outside the normal what we're used to seeing. Now, we go to the sprint that afternoon. Now, we have to say that the earlier part of the week and that Friday was a very hot day. The temperature cooled down some on Saturday. Was it really a big difference for Rich, or was it just a little bit, or what were temperatures like there?
It was a pretty big difference, actually. I mean, I don't know if you can see my, this doesn't work for the Motorpod listeners, but Jim's looking at me. I'm still quite burnt because, as usual, I go after these events with no sun cream. And it was, I don't know precisely what the temperature was on Thursday and Friday, but they were hot, sunny days. It was probably, I'm obviously talking Celsius because that's the currency that we deal in here, but probably 28, 29 degrees, possibly even a little bit hotter down in the paddock because obviously there's a lot of concrete, asphalt and all the rest of it. I would say it was at least 5 to 6 degrees Celsius cooler.
That's a lot.
And it was overcast as well, so we didn't have the sun beating down. It was a big difference, yeah.
So going into the sprint that afternoon, there was a lot of talk about what everybody was going to do with the front tire. So it was like, okay, who's going to play this game? Well, Aleix loves the hard front because he likes how it feels underneath the braking. So he went with a hard front, stuck to his guns on that one. Mark Marquez went with the hard front, but Benyai and Bastianini both went with the medium, which is kind of what Michelin wanted everybody to be on. You know, Michelin was like, hey, it's a lot cooler. Go with the medium. That's what you're going to need. Go with that. So, okay, cool. The sprint starts. Martin gets a great hole shot. He beats Aleix to the first turn, followed by Bastianini and Binder. Now, Bezzecchi gets taken out in the first turn when Morbidelli, I don't know what he was thinking, but he just completely went full send in that corner, lost the bike, slid into the back of Bezzecchi and knocked him off in a vicious kind of high, in a vicious way. I mean, they were down in the gravel trap for a little bit. Now, we would later come to find out that Morbidelli would get a double long lap or just a long lap penalty for double. His indiscretions. Double, yes.
Mm-hmm.
He got a double, checks notes. He had a double long lap penalty. The amazing part is Morbidelli's like, I didn't do anything. Like, watch the video again, bro. You completely botched that turn. Like, did you forget to brake? There's people who were speculating that it was, you know, the ride height device wasn't working. Some people were speculating that the hole shot device hadn't released and whatnot. So it was, you know, in that like dragster mode. So it didn't want to turn. You know what? If it was, and I don't think it was, because that was all speculation that I heard. But if the bike isn't right, you as a rider know that. You can't go barreling into the corner expecting to somehow magically fix it when you get there. You know, I mean, you are required to be in control of that motorcycle regardless. And man, that was just a boneheaded move. I mean, it was really, really stupid.
I've only seen the replays on TV. I was actually sat in the stand for the sprint race that's on the inside of the Abbey turn. So I kind of saw that go on. I think we posted it on Instagram. When I saw it on the replay, I mean, we're talking tiny margins, aren't we, Jim, in terms of, you're half a second late at hitting the brake. The closing distance is significant, but he just looked to be completely out of control. And it is a bit of a pattern of behaviour with Morbidelli, and he does get himself into these situations. I mean, Bezzecchi was down for a long time. I mean, obviously they don't show this on the TV coverage. I was on the other side of the track watching, and he took that. In fact, they stretched him off because there was the yellow flag was out for, I think, the better part of two laps, which is a long time at
Yeah.
Silverstone because it's a long lap. So Morbidelli kind of hobbled off with assistance reasonably quickly, and Bezzecchi, as I say, was stretching off, and it took him a long time to recover the bike because Bezzecchi's bike was in several kind of detached pieces, all just about hanging together. So hence the long yellow flag. So yeah, just a boneheaded move, really.
Yeah, he got what he deserved. I mean, he got the double long lap.
Yeah.
So after the first front three guys, it was Binder and Acosta. Now they touched, and Binder basically just cleaned the entire left side aerodynamics off of Pedro's bike, which was not good. I mean, there was shards of carbon fiber everywhere again. I think we know how I feel about that one and how unsafe that is there. So that all came down, and that made Marc Marquez fifth. Martin was out front. He stays out front, and Bagnaia got a track limits warning with eight to go. I'm like, wow. Good grief. It's a long lap at Silverstone, but come on, let's control yourself at least somewhat. Then Bagnaia went down at turn four after setting the fastest lap. Now he was just trying to make his way up to both the Beast and Martin. And I don't know why the front folded on him. He had the medium on. He definitely had it bedded in. And he had just set, as you rightly said earlier in the show, Rich, he had just said fastest lap, but for whatever reason, down it went. Don't know why.
In terms of what I saw, he might have been a few inches offline, perhaps, just as he turned it in. Hard to say from the angles, but really odd crash, really hard one to explain. But when you're pushing that hard at the very front of the field, doesn't take much to go down. But again, and this is not a criticism, what's that, the fourth or fifth crash he's had in a sprint this year? It's
Yep.
quite a lot. So it's lucky, really, that Martin's been doing the same thing, albeit in the main races. So, yeah, Bagnaia, I'm not saying he's lucky, but he kind of gets away with these little mistakes because his main competitor's doing similar things or worse.
Very, very true. So it was a three-rider battle up front. Martin Bezzecchi or Martin Bastianini, then Aleix, followed by Marc Marquez, then Binder, then Acosta, then Alex Marquez. Then the Beast at Cobb's Corner was just a wow. He just went up through Cobb, then Bastianini then led going through that whole complex of, Cobb's, Maggots, Becketts, and then he led down to Stowe or whatever. Martin then got a track limit warning with like three to go. And then with two to go, Marc Marquez was down at turn 16. He lost the front on the trail break. You could see him just trail breaking way deep. He broke late. He was trailing it to the corner. That's a tricky place to be. Go that late, that deep on that front. You got to have all the feel in the world, and he didn't have it. And the bike just slid out of him. So Bastianini wins his first ever sprint race. He keeps Martin from taking full advantage. And at that point, I think Martin was one solitary point ahead of Bagnaia. So Bagnaia owed Bastianini a drink, that's for sure. Aleix got a podium, which was great for him. Then Binder, then Acosta, and then Alex Marquez. So that wraps up the sprint. Now we got to figure out what was going to happen on Sunday. Now, on Sunday, Morbidelli did have the double long lap. There were spots of rain that showed up. And was it going to be a flag-to-flag race? Were we going to be changing bikes? Now, the Moto3 race did have a few spots of rain that was there. But, English summer became English summer. And, well, we didn't have to worry about rain. It just was just there, just a little bit, just to kind of give us that, well, maybe kind of a thing. Again, we got this whole thing with the front tires again. We are a lot cooler, than we were on Friday. And again, Aleix sticks with his guns and he goes with the hard. You then had Vinales and Oliveira were on a medium, but the Ducatis were on a hard as well, which was Raul was on a hard too. Then everybody else was on a medium. So that was kind of interesting. Give Aleix credit. He loves that tire. He's going to run with it. But the question was, could he generate enough heat? Now we know the Aprilia front downforce gives them a lot more energy that they're putting through that tire carcass. So it probably was going to work for him. At the start of the race, Bagnaia got a hole shot followed by Martin, Aleix, Bastianini, Marc Marquez, and Alex Marquez. Binder went to basically last place, and the bike then eventually stopped. So that was kind of crazy as well. So not sure what happened to Bender, other than he had, some kind of problem. The KTM computer said kaput, and that is all that I can say for that one there. Oliveira and Raul crashed. They were down. And then Bastianini was wide at Brooklands, and Martin got by, but Bagnaia was pulling away. But Aleix got by Bastianini. It's like, well, okay, now Aleix is going to go run down Bagnaia. Excuse me, sorry. Bagnaia is sliding it into Martin's, is sliding backwards into Martin's clutches. Martin was starting to come on. He was starting to get close to him there, but he wasn't quite there yet. Bagnaia was still leading. But Digia and Alex Marquez were going back and forth for six. They had a good little ding dong fight there. They'd pass, repass, pass, repass. I mean, they did go side by side for about a lap, maybe two, which was quite the race there as well. So that was kind of nice. Now, 11 laps to go, still Bagnaia and Martin, but they have a gap to Aleix. They're starting to drop Aleix. Is it the hard tire on the front? Not sure. Then there's Bastianini, then Marc Marquez. Bastianini then with 10 to go gets by Aleix. So Bagnaia is still out front, and everybody's still in course. Then Martin gets by with a great move at turn three. So that was right before you turn and go back onto the Wellington straight, I believe. So it was a great move by Martin. He took up the track, left it to where, Bagnaia didn't have any choice. But then Martin returned the favor. He went wide at turn three, but then Bastianini was catching them, and it was becoming a three-rider battle. So we kind of got those guys are all there. But Martin had put about a half a second on everybody and on Bagnaia and Bastianini. But Bagnaia was losing pace. It was like seven to go. He didn't quite have the pace. Bagnaia was wide at Brooklyn, and then Bastianini was by. And now Bastianini's chasing Martin. And Martin's trying his best there, but we're not sure because it's looking like the beast with the great tire life that he gets was going to probably make a run at him. Marc Marquez would get by Aleix, and then Martin was still leading with four to go, ahead of Bastianini, ahead of Bagnaia. Now Bagnaia had a really long gap to Marc Marquez, then to Aleix, but Di Giantonio had slipped in there to the sixth spot. With two to go, Martin was deep into turn three, and Bastianini just went by. Like Bastianini didn't even have to work for this one. He got there, got close, but Martin made the mistake, went too deep, and then Bastianini would win the race, followed by Martin. Bagnaia would come home in third, followed by Marc Marquez, Digia, Aleix, Alex Bezzecchi. Acosta was ninth, the top KTM rider. Not a good weekend for KTM. I don't think that Silverstone is exactly a great track for Acosta. He does seem to have a smidge of trouble there. He did as a Moto3 rider. He's having it now as a MotoGP rider, but he did have success in Moto2 there. He did have a pole position. So I'm not sure. Whatever it is, the KTMs are not good enough. And Pit Beyer and the boys are going to have to work extra hard to get those running. But it was a good race. It was a clever race that was ran by Bagnaia so that he, or by Bagnaia, by Ben Bastianini, for him to be able to get the win. Rich, how was it at the track?
Yeah, MotoGP bikes are always great to watch at the side of a track, wherever you are. So, a couple of observations, really, and I'll keep this short because we're way running over. But Maverick Vinales had a big crash in qualifying, and having shown well on the Friday, he just didn't really materialize in either the sprint or the main race on the Sunday. So, that will have gladdened the hearts in some places. High hopes for Maverick going into Silverstone. He's done well. He had obviously had his original first win in MotoGP on the Suzuki all the way back in, what would that have been, 2017, maybe something like
Way back, yeah.
that. So Maverick was a bit of a conundrum as usual. I speculated from some of my sort of paddock talks that I'd put onto Instagram on Friday and Saturday as to how effective Martin would be. Would the Ducati support start to, or the perhaps the ebbing away of the Ducati support, would that start to manifest? You might say that it did a little bit because he didn't win either of the races, but Martin was still very, very strong. The thing that I really caught from trackside for the Sunday MotoGP race, Jim, I was stood down on the exit of, oh golly, what's the term called? I'm struggling to think now. It's the hairpin, basically, where the long lap is before they head off into the fast
Oh,
Woodcote.
Brooklands.
Brooklands, thank you. The Hondas.
Woodcock.
Well, Woodcote's the fast turn after Brooklands.
It's Brooklyn, yeah.
As they gas out of that hairpin, basically where the long lap penalty loop is, the Honda just looked awful, really vicious. You can see the riders trying to get it up onto the fat part of the tyre, no surprise there. But where the Ducati just powered out of there, and okay, they've all got seamless gearboxes, the Ducati just kept going, whereas the Honda, you could just see the rear tire jumping, really upsetting the rear suspension as it kind of looked for grip. So I don't know if that's a chassis issue, if that's a electronics issue in terms of the map of the engine, just the sheer brutality of the engine itself. But you could see them, all of the Honda riders, but Mir in particular, I thought, really fighting to keep that thing in a straight line. And it just really looks like a handful still, the Honda. Whereas the Yamaha wasn't markedly better, it's true, in terms of performance and results over the weekend, but certainly is a much sweeter looking thing from trackside. So that was one thing I noticed. The only other thing to mention really was Jack Miller, who had quite a good weekend, but very, very downbeat in terms of his prospects of staying in the series. I think, it's all but over for Miller. And, he's in the media scrums on the Friday and the Saturday that I was there, really quite emotional about the fact that he's kind of in his last, what would have been a 10 races in MotoGP, and not even with a decent World Superbike offer on the table either. So whether he goes off and has a sabbatical, if there's any way back from there, but he really did cut a very dejected figure, which was odd because, okay, you could say, as you just did, KTMs did not perform well overall at Silverstone, and that's obviously true, but Miller had a much better weekend overall than he's been enjoying in recent rounds, or all year, in fact. So yeah, just quite sad, really. I feel kind of, I mean, it's hard to feel sympathy for people that have earned millions of dollars doing what they love, but he really looks like a guy that's very upset to be kind of stood up whilst the music stops in a game of musical chairs at the minute, and it's sad to see, really. But he's not the future of KTM, is he? I mean, he's out. So you can argue the whys and wherefores of particularly Maverick Viñales getting onto the KTM at Tech 3. I mean, that still, for me, is a shock. But yeah, poor old Jack. Looks like the game's almost up.
Yeah, Alonso and Acosta are the future of KTM.
Yes.
I think it's obvious, right? And if KTM doesn't have Alonso on a long contract, they are stupid.
I'd throw
You know?
Vaya into the mix on that one as well, Jim, as well, because he looks
Oh,
like
sure.
red hot as well for Moto2 and obviously MotoGP ultimately.
Yep. I think KTM has some great talent coming, but KTM needs to fix their bike. They're missing something. Don't know what. I don't think Pit Beirer and the boys know what they're missing yet. I mean, they were like gangbusters early in the year, but Ducati kind of starts slow and then gradually increases and gets better. And KTM cannot keep pace with that for some reason. And hopefully they can figure that out because, I mean, at some point, everybody's going to have to start thinking about 26 and, there people are going to have to start putting 850cc motors on dynos. Literally, probably by the early, at the latest, you'd probably want to, would be the beginning of next year, right? So, I mean, I think that would be the latest I'd want anybody to be, wanting to start dyno testing and droning one around in a mule situation, kind of a thing, just to put miles on them. But yeah, it's tough to watch KTM sort of implode, it's for sure.
Well, I think that might be perhaps a slightly harsh take on it. I mean, we must remember that Ducati have been at this a lot longer than KTM or Aprilia have. So
Sure.
they do have that, obviously, in their favour in terms of that experience and that strength and depth, et cetera, et cetera. But I entirely agree with what you say, Jim. Ducati start the year, if anything, they tend to start the year, although less so this year, it's true, perhaps trying to understand the updates that they bring, and then they get much better as the year goes on and they bring updates and they work. Whereas KTM, and I think you could argue Aprilia as well, kind of start the year strong and then they sort of fall behind in the development race. So comparative to Ducati, it makes them look kind of even worse. But yeah, I mean, for sure, they're not where they need to be. And as evidenced by the fact that Acosta himself is starting to slip back and is crashing a bit more as well as part of the overall theme as well, which is perhaps not a big surprise because we did speculate that as he got into his rookie season, that that might be one of the results of him pushing to find the limits more and more and more. Allied to which now he's trying to push a bike to do things that it probably doesn't want to do. So yeah, I mean, that's the nature of sport, isn't it? It's warfare. So some people win, some people lose, and that changes over time. But nobody's beating a Ducati this year. I mean, that's patently obvious now.
Yep, for sure. I think it was a great weekend of racing. I think every race was a good race. There wasn't a bad one. There wasn't a snoozer per se.
Yep.
We have done the points where we are from that. So let's look at the World Championship standings for MotoGP. With Martins second place in both the sprint and in the MotoGP race, he has 241 points to Bagnaia's 238. So it's only a 3-point lead that Martin has coming into it. Bastianini is now on 192, which puts him 49 behind Martin, and 46 behind his teammate Bagnaia. Bastianini might be believing that he can win this title. The other two are prone to making mistakes, and the beast doesn't really make the mistakes that the other two make.
True.
Now, if he puts a little more pressure on there, if the beast can put a string of a couple of race wins together, this could become a three-horse race. And what is Ducati going to do then? Because the two other people that are chasing their main guy for a championship are going to leave.
Well, they've been booted out, I think, which is perhaps adds a bit more color to the scenario.
Yes, I'm sorry. Okay, the two other guys who are going to potentially win the world championship for Ducati got booted by Ducati in favor of other people.
Yeah, one of whom is falling further and further and further behind.
Yes, because after Bastianini is Marquez, who is only on 179 points, who keeps falling and losing points. So he's 62 behind Martin and only 13 behind Bastianini. So, I mean, we'll have to see how that all plays out. But yeah, it's going to get interesting because, well, I mean, I at some point, Martin has to quit getting updates. You cannot be Ducati and give him the new stuff because that's going to information he's going to take to Aprilia, right?
Yeah.
So you definitely don't want to do that. Bastianini is going to go to KTM. Probably really don't want to let Bastianini go to KTM with new parts and updates. So is Bagnaia going to be the only people who's going to get an update, or is Ducati not going to give them any updates at all? Because they tend to put the updates out there for everybody, and they work together for that solution because they're looking at all the data for everybody to find out whether that part is actually better than the part that they replaced it with. And it's like, okay, I understand that, but at some point, yeah, hard decisions are going to have to be made. And who knows? I mean, I still think that Ducati is winning this world title regardless, but it's
Oh,
going to be
yeah.
interesting as which one.
Yeah. You could actually foresee them pushing some of the updates in DiGiantonio's direction, actually, because he will be a good guy to test them out. And we know he's on a works bike next year. So he's one of the favoured ones now.
Yep.
Yeah. They can't conceivably kind of fully support Martin because why the hell would they? It just doesn't make any sense. And a decision not to bring him up and because he's going elsewhere. So yeah, totally agree with you.
Yeah. All right. I think that about does it, Rich. This is a monster episode from a monster racetrack and from a monster weekend with monster sponsorship. And anyway,
Well, nicely done, sir.
every now and then I get an alliteration correct. Yeah, blind squirrel finds a nut. Anyway.
I know I've told you, Gemma, this has gone way too long, but I'm the schmuck that has to edit this one and put it out. So Monster Energy, as you quite rightly pointed out, sponsored the event. I mean, I wonder what they think about the attendance. But anyway, irrespective of that, they were just the whole weekend just giving out free cans of Monster Energy drink, all the different varieties, just constantly giving away cans. I mean, Les got through a few hundred thousand cans. You think, I always stand and think, how the bloody hell does that company make any money? Because the money they put into sponsorship, riders, teams, events, extreme sports, blah, 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 you name it, then the promo stuff and giveaways, they must sell a hell of a lot of cans of drink to make any of that add up financially. Yeah, it's a business model that I do not understand at all.
Red Bull pioneered it, man. I mean, they're the same way.
Yeah, but I was very grateful indeed for some cans of energy drink during the weekend because it was quite a tiring weekend because you can walk a lot of distance at Silverstone, like most tracks. So great job by Monster. Can I just say before we go, just a quick shout out, new subscriber, Michael Cowan. I hope I got that right. Michael's come on as a Patreon financial subscriber, importantly. We need more. And one of the guys that I met at the hotel that I was staying at, Jordan Gruby from, I think he said he's from Aberdeen, come on and linked up with our Instagram page. Please, 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 listeners, there are thousands of you out there. Do us a favor. If you can't subscribe financially to the show, do just please link up to the Instagram page, the Motorpod official channel. That will help us a lot because we did put out a lot of content over the course of the weekend in terms of photos and videos and stuff, which hopefully people enjoy. I mean, that's obviously why we do it. So if you can, it's at official underscore Motopod. That's the Instagram channel. I think Insta is kind of the main one that we want to push. I'm a bit dubious about Threads, and X is so kind of venal, it's probably best avoided most of the time for various reasons. So, and Insta's good because it's predominantly photos and video. So that's what people want to see in terms of short content. So if you can subscribe to the at official_motopod Instagram channel. That would be a great help because currently we have 137 followers, which isn't too bad because we only started it last year. But I'd like to see that well into the hundreds, many hundreds actually. And we've got enough people downloading the show every time to warrant it. And most people I would have thought would be on Instagram. So if you can, please do. It'll help.
Alrighty, folks, with all that, I think we will sign off from this one because it was a monster show. Be sure to follow us on the socials, as Rich has pointed out. And with that, I will tell you all, ride safe.
Thanks, everyone.